星空を眺めている一人きりの夜明けもたった一つの心悲しみに暮れないで君のため息なぬて春風に変えてやる日の当たる坂道を自転車で駆け上る君となるした思い出乗せてゆくよララララララ口ずさむ唇を染めてゆく君の見つけた幸せ花のように
And we've got Dean the Colonel Sanders come back. I'm just trying that on nickname for you, bros.
my brother and my dad would kill you for it. That's a title they reserve for themselves.
Okay, sweet. All right. So Lieutenant Sanders. initiated fella, Waramai. Man, been on the pod a few times. He's very much in a big brother guidance kind of role for me. I don't know, for better or worse, he's been assigned the role of keeping me on track in the world. from some of his old people and from Spirit and his way of working in the world. And so this is a bit of a HR session, which, if it doesn't get too personal, then this will be on a podcast. I think Dean's done about three before with us, sort of a regular traveler in here. So I basically got a couple of problems. One of them is an addiction problem. I'm kind of addicted to Americans at the moment. They're just so entertaining and they make me feel good. But then afterwards that they just leave me feeling hollow and empty inside. And just the amount of time I've been spending with Americans and in certain, cultural and ideological sort of groups of people that I've been exploring in the world, especially looking into tech and DeFi and all this kind of stuff. We're a bit worried that I've, like, in anthropological terms, that I've gone native, and Dean's going to try and tether me back into our culture again, because I think I've gone off the old reservation a bit, as the more racist Americans say, which, that at the moment, that's my people at the moment, and I just want to bring myself back to this continent. So this is a bit of a HR sort of session culturally. How you going, bros?
Look, I'm all right, brother. It's good to see you. Good to spend time with you. I think we can start in that sort of that general area, of talking about. I'd probably say that you can never be off the reservation, to use that, as you say, that framing with our culture, because our culture is accommodating of everything. I think the story today is that everything you've been doing, every journey you've been on, is not just informed by culture because it's in you, but should be informed by culture because it needs to be in them. And that's part, I think, of what we sort of want to speak to today. That the story, the journey we've been on, you and I, which relates to the journey you've been on in terms of working through the next iteration of what the world needs through your work, in the combination of bringing all of that stuff together, new economics, new constructs of IoT, new constructs of AI, new constructs of identity. Now, all those things are important, but I guess the story that I want to talk to today is, and all of those things, that our people, our old people, have already solved all of those things and made decisions about them in our past, not just stumbled on them, but made active cultural decisions about what is the right way to do something, what is the wrong way to do something. And I guess that the opportunity today is how do we dig back into that? How do we anchor you, tether you, if you like, drive a nail into your foot and keep you anchored around that campsite for a bit, so we can remind you that the strength of what you're taking into those conversations, in fact, is already there. It's in the landscape. It's in that culture. And then that's the message that you wanted to take to the world, and it's the message that the world needs to hear. So that's the encouragement to our dialogue. I want to give you comfort that you can never get off the reservation. You know, our culture is the living universe. Our culture covers every aspect of what we can see and not see. So you can never get far enough away. You can never escape it entirely.
That's it. You can try and walk away, but you're still defined by it. Even if you're defined by your rejection of it.
That's right.
Or refusal to acknowledge it, it's still who you're going to be in relation to that. You're always going to be in relation to it. It's like one of those cults. It's like Scientology. You can't get away from it. Huh? They'll track you down.
it's one of those cults where you get to sit around in a campfire under the stars. A little bit. It asks a bit less of you in that regard. You don't need to give you your whole bank account and savings. You know. Not a requirement. But, you know, one of the things that occurred
to me... It's like you don't have to do the things. You don't have to do the things, but you kind of do as well. You kind of do, but there's not really any consequence if you don't do them.
Well, our culture is one, and picks up on that point, if you like, about the idea that it's freedom. It's a culture of freedom, but it is anchored in process. And that might sound like they're mutually exclusive, but the reality is that that our old people have worked out that only good process can lead to good outcomes. And the outcome you let go of, but the process you can't let go of. And so it becomes practice, it becomes living, it becomes a way of thinking and engaging in the world. And that's true for the web 3.0 characters, for every other integral theorist, for every other cybernetics guru. It's all informed by the way we process things. So let's talk about that for a second. It just occurred to me that when you were referencing earlier that you've been spending some time in American dialogue, so I can see a future book, you know, Tyson in America or something like that, you know.
Oh, the culture is just like cocaine. It's it's great. You just feel so good when you're talking to them. It's like, hey, and they're so happy. Even they live such a precarious existence, but it's that. They all have that kind of, I think they've really taken on board that exceptionalism thing. Even if they critique it, they're just all, I don't know, they pick you up. But then an hour later, you feel like crap again because you're still in this Antipodean reality.
Well, I don't get to be there. Yeah.
And look, I guess here's my problem is I'm feeling untethered. I'm feeling untethered from culture and from country and everything. I've been in this sort of Zoomy online space for a couple of years because of the COVID. I can't get home very often. And when I do, it's usually to deal with emergencies and, deaths and bloody, horrible things going on. So I don't get time to spend time on country. I don't get to do any culture stuff or everything's just... it's very, very hard. And so I'm doing all of my knowledge and connection and everything is all just happening through being mediated through these screens. And I'm like, and I think the epistemology is still strong, the ways of knowing and then the knowledge in terms of just speaking it as information, that's all good. But in terms of ontology and actual being, how am I really in relation now? And I know you've got ways of dealing with that, but I haven't dealt with it very well. I feel very disconnected and really quite ill, terminally ill from that state of disconnection I'm in.
And I think that's an important sort of thing to share. We're all of us, I think, and this is one of the great dangers of our society, we are all of us, frankly, in stages of dissolution, stages of death. That's the reality. Don't get busy living, get busy dying. That's something that all of the people you're speaking to are experiencing too. We're all in that stages, and COVID just reminds us of those issues of mortality. But that's okay in our culture, as the way we respond to that is by anchoring ourselves in relationship to the landscape we're on. And that's a mistake in this conversation already, because normally I'm joining you from my country. And so I don't even need to acknowledge, because I'm in it and I'm part of it. But today I'm joining you from Wanamaragal land in Sydney, which is a Sydney place. So I'm not on country. I'm obviously on somebody else's country. And my relationship to this country is lived and professional, but it doesn't nurture me the same way. It doesn't nourish me the same way. And I feel it. I literally feel it in my body. I feel it in the way I think and the way I work. So I have to have my things around me just to keep me anchored, you know, and all the stuff, stuff that you do too, to keep me haptically connected.
Number seven, boy.
And so I do that to keep me connected. But it is important to acknowledge that this country is still rich and still informs us, still connects us. You know, I'm on one of a country, and the elders of this country are powerful, and they have been traumatized and they have been challenged, but they are here and they're here with us today. And your connection to the country you're on needs to be activated too. It needs to be connected in this conversation, because we're joining through Zoom, but we're not joining through Zoom as you and I. We're connected through the physical connections of our countries, even though neither of us are on our country right now. And then when you bring in the fifth dimension of Zoom, you can see why this already begins to fracture.
Yeah,
the whole systems begin to fracture. And we've got to find our way back to those things in the conversation.
Well, I've got particularly fractured here. Every time I talk from here, I'm split, because this is my born country. I'm like just a couple of k's away from where I was born, and like I know, you know, and I connect quite strongly with the groundwater in this place, because that's where my spirit came out of when I was born. It comes straight out of that groundwater and into me there, you know, here in this place, on this country. But, you know, also I got no claim here as well.
What claims you though? It claims you.
Well, you know, I never thought I'd, I mean, I've never been here since I was a baby, like, you know, like I left out from here a few months old, as far as I know. And never came back. I'm from Queensland. And then, you know, lost family and all that sort of thing. And so finish up and claimed by another country. And I'm there. And that's who I am. And then suddenly I've ended up here. Not through any decision of my own or plan, but finished up here. And now I'm kind of stuck here. I'm stuck here for about another 2 or 3 years. And it's strange that I've ended up, you know, it just happens that this is where my woman's staying, like a couple of k's away from where I was born. And so I'm forced to be back in some kind of not quite relation with a place that I feel really disconnected from. So I'm here on Boonwurrung country and just not feeling it, you know. It's very, yeah, very, you know, difficult.
My response to that would be that I think you're talking there about, and it does relate to our other conversation, you know, the conversation about the future, is I think you're talking there about the idea of your physical self and the way you walk through the world, which obviously, as you say, has been informed by your culture and familial relations in Queensland. That's who you present in the world. That's how you connect with the world. That's how you travel through the world. But that's how you travel on top of the land. The land itself, that land you're on, it recognizes you. But your physical self has been trained about different things. So the land, now that I know that about you, I've got a whole different perspective on why you're stuck there. You know, my sense is that you are there for a particular reason. You are there because the land wants you to be there. You've got some work to do in relation to the land recognizes you, but you're not necessarily able to recognize and engage in the relationship with that land, because so much of your walking across the land identity is connected to your Queensland cultural.
You know. Well, that was my feeling and that was my thought for about a year when I first come in here. You know, but then I had a bit of a knock and it didn't feel that way anymore.
But let me guess, you had a knock from people, not from the land.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not talking about the people. I'm talking about the land. People yeah, will often, no, this is the challenge, this is the conversation, the challenge you're facing with your other dialogues, is that all of those things are represented through people. Human beings are inherently flawed, as are all of us, obviously, and will interpret and relate to that world in their particular way. So those people that you've had challenges with or disconnection with, or who've facilitated your disconnection down there, they're speaking from their own personal relationships and identity relationships with that landscape. That's not yours. The land knows you.
Mm.
It doesn't know you through them.
Mm.
It knows you directly.
Mm.
You know, that's something that might be something. Of course, we are taught that relationship should be navigated, should be cultivated, should be curated through others of that land.
Mm.
But if they're not there for you, you also know that the land is always there for you.
Mm.
The land wants a direct relationship with you, and it will enrich you and nurture you when you get a chance to do that. Mm. And that might be part of the thing that's keeping you stuck.
Yeah. Well, she does step in from time to time. I can't deny it. Like, but usually when I'm about to do something I can't come back from. Yeah. And then that sign will come more like, be pretty, you know, severe event, weather event, or you know, or that, you know, I don't know. Most recently, that whiteout came right up, and just fucking wouldn't let me keep going. Stop, right there, you know, right in front of my face. Wouldn't move until I turned back. You know, that happens. Yeah. So yeah, I know it's there. I'm just struggling with that. I think that's a whole nother session though. And that's a separate issue. I think it's part of, yeah, that's part of like what has knocked my protection down and has made me a bit more vulnerable to becoming untethered, you know, in this space as I'm enduring online and with people, you know, from overseas and other places. I might be getting a little seduced, you know, into different ways of thinking and cultures and things like that.
Yeah. So let's flip it around then, because you're right, it's probably another yarn, but let's flip it around to the idea that, so if the goal of this conversation and the work you're doing is to come to a completion relationship with your new book and the sort of enormous spaces you've been traversing, the extraordinary wildernesses you've been, you know, cutting through with a big bloody, you know, technological machete. And you know, that's why I think you're operating in this whole, you know, sort of blackfellow David Attenborough space. Yeah, you've taken reverse anthropology to a whole new level, you know. But and that, you know, I can see you with your little pith helmet and, you know, and you're slashing your way through the jungles. But I think you could be, if that's the goal of the conversation, let's talk about some of those things you've been discovering on this journey. Let's talk about some of those things you've been finding and which ones have taken you down a path, because I think what we want to try and do here is say, well, you know, so our old people, our culture has already answered those questions, has already found a way, and I mean this very seriously, that people look upon Aboriginal culture and say, oh, it's some sort of savage thing, it's some sort of thing that we needed to evolve from. But you know, all the evidence tells us something quite radically different. It tells us that no, our old people looked into many of these questions, faced these demons, stared into those same jungles and said, no, not that way. No, that's not our story. We're going a different way.
Well, so that was the danger of their embassy and their anthropology. You know, like a century and a half back. And that was the danger of it, because they did that. You know, they got on the ships, a lot of them old fellas, and they went, you know, they went to Europe and they went to the Americas. And I guess their intent with that role was that they would study and that there would be an inquiry and they bring back knowledge, and that they'd make some kind of embassy as well. But it wasn't, I guess they weren't expecting that asymmetrical power relationship. Is the way the people in the Northern Hemisphere saw them really kind of, I don't know, destroyed that to the point that it's just, that's why it's a joke, this idea of reverse anthropology. It's not actually possible to study back because you can't stand on that same ground, on that same footing. So, you know, those old fellas, they might have seen themselves in a kind of anthropological or ambassadorial kind of role, but the way other people saw them was performers and curiosities to keep in a cage and let out a couple of times a week to perform in the traveling show, throw a boomerang, do a little dance, you know, in the lap and all that sort of thing. People walk past and look at you in the cage and poke you with sticks and all that kind of thing. And they died there. Anyway, I guess, you know, I kind of feel like, even though I'm physically, I haven't gone there, I don't know, there's some part of my soul that's been like extracted and converted to zeros and ones.
Well, no, I can see a reading of your life right now is that you are taking that same journey just in digital form. Mm. But I would say that what that story forgets is that all of those realities existed, all of those things occurred, all of those power asymmetries have been lived out and traumatizing across our nation. But the thing that's missing that our old people knew is that the dimension that's missing from those dialogues is time.
Mm-hmm.
That all happened because our culture, which had you know, 100,000 years of evolutionary adaptation and perfection, came into relationship with a system that was cycling at a different rate, you know, and was still infant-like in terms of those things like power and greed and selfishness and narcissism, all those elements that have typified much of that, you know, post-enlightenment, if you like, if that's a simpler, I think it's well and truly pre-enlightenment also, but nonetheless, we frame it in this post-enlightenment sort of context. Yeah. So the difference is time. And that means we've got to look back. We've got to look back to, so what were the lessons? What were the lessons of culture from that now can solve some of those problems, that now can inform the way we might navigate some of these increasing complexities? So just as an example is that, you know, some of the questions that I've heard raised, that some of the challenges that sort of emerge around, even if we step into something like Web 3.0, just the idea that, you know, that Web 3.0 is somehow a holy grail because it democratizes the construct of contract, if you like, just to simplify it down to that. You know, somehow it's about exchanges of authority in a democratic way rather than a you know, singularly held way. Now, even that's the pinnacle of thinking amongst that community, that's somehow the pinnacle of opportunity. It's when you hear all this conversation like, well, you know, the perfect future is a perfect democracy. When you know, all it is improvements on the present horror. They can't escape the simple vortex that maybe the whole idea is wrong. Maybe the whole construct of contract is wrong. So if Web 3.0 is just another form of equality of contracting, well, but maybe if the construct of contract is wrong, then Web 3.0 can only be another version of that death, just another iteration of that path to death.
A smart contract as opposed to the clever process that our old people.
Exactly. Our old people said, well, the hell's a contract? If you do the right thing, if you follow the right process, the right outcomes occur.
But there's a difference between smart and clever.
That's right. Yeah, that's
right. And there's clever things behind our processes that hold them in place. Yeah.
And I think that over time we've lost an understanding of some of those. And I don't pretend, by the way, to be the holder of that knowledge, but over time we have lost an understanding of what those things actually mean in the modern context. So the thing I've been wrestling with, the thing that's been my question to you all the way through our relationship has been that whenever I see these problems emerge in the modern, I'll use that word deliberately, construct of the future ideation, is that it's all just new versions of the old, faster, more convenient, more technological, more digital. But they are all still missing, and this is my challenge to you about the American dialogues you've been having, they're all still missing something that I've had difficult communicating. They're all missing this binding construct of law, L-O-R-E, which is not, I don't mean that in the context of story or, you know, I mean it in the whole construct of how it connects us to each other, how it connects us to the landscape, connects us to responsibility. So all of those things, all of those solutions, I don't care what it is, what is newly invented, if it is absent law, it will, it will destruct. It is inevitable. Its destruction is inevitable. And I think that's the risk that we've currently got. So my
I feel that entropy in myself.
Yeah.
From this untethering I'm telling you about, you know, it's an untethering from law, and you just feel yourself falling apart. You can't live without it.
And because it binds us, it connects us. And law isn't a singular transaction. It's not one way. And that's why I say to you before we even started that part of this is my responsibility in not being able to, not being available or able to necessarily provide that support as well for you, because our whole civilization as we currently live it fights against every aspect of that. You know, I have to fight my way into culture myself. You know, I have to fight. I live in a corporate world. I live in a family world, and I live in a cultural world. And every one of those battles with each other in terms of power. And then, you know, and every one of them negotiates with each other. Now, they're not separate, of course. But the way we prioritize them in the way we think about our relationship to each day is prioritized differently. And that's the challenge you find yourself, because you're offering a different digital never world.
That
makes that really hard.
It doesn't seem to bother you, though. You got that same thing that I find with those one of those clever people in Canada who did the smoking. I keep coming back to this, but it blew me away. They did the smoking ceremony. I smelled the smoke, you know, from the other side of the world. And they were like, you know, and I'm like, what? I'm like, exactly. That's what they said. You know, of course you can't smell the smoke. Why would you not be able to smell the smoke? I'm like, you know, it's so different. I don't know. But you see, you do that thing. I don't know. We both like do this thing where we're probably more than what we put across sometimes. Like, I know you do. You're always like, you know, humble and stuff, and you're like, oh, I'm just here being your brother and looking out for you. But then, you know, you do that. I see that clever eye every now and then. It makes me look away.
We've got stuff to, that's part of it.
You're watching me in that way. I can see it, you know. But then it's the same way that they've got their, I don't know, but it's different, you know. Ceremony is different, and the authority that comes with that law that you're talking, it's different here from how it is there. They all have an individual connection to it. And it's individualized, and they work through it individually, and they do ceremony all the time. You know, like for us, ceremony is a big deal, and it's a little bit scary. I mean, quite scary. So to the point that most of our young fellows will run away. You know what I mean? Like when, and so in Canada, like the people I'm talking to, you know, they're always like, oh yes, and I've got to do, I don't know, whatever, you know, ceremony for the Great Spirit, you know, for finding my car keys. And, you know, like they just do it. They do it all the time, like for everything. You know, it's like, oh, somebody's got to do a ceremony for the spirit of alcohol for doing all this work for us during COVID for hand sanitizers. You know, like, and they'll just do it. And one of them will just step up and do it. They individually, I don't know, they do ceremony for everything. And it's very kind of loving and connected, and they feel very confident individually just to run ceremony for himself. But in our way, it's not like that, you know. This, it's very connected to authority, and when the old fellas come, it's terrifying, you know, and a lot of us will hide from it, you know. I was talking to my son about it. It's like we were laughing because it's like he reckons it's like Lord of the Rings, like that first Fellowship of the Ring when the hobbits are getting chased by the those wraiths, and it's like, you know, get off the road, and, you know, run, Mr. Frodo, run. It's kind of like that when the old fellas come for ceremony. I remember when all the young fellas will scatter, and half the time the old fellas have to steal them out of their beds and take them to get them to go, because it's not easy. It's really hard, and it's really terrifying, and a lot of us don't even want to do it.
I think the thing that matters there, without stepping too much into the particularities around that stuff, as you know, we can't always talk about. But what I would say is it certainly requires commitment.
Mm.
And that's the important part of it. It's actually the commitment that matters.
Mm.
So you need to know that you are going to do something that will change you. I'm not even talking about ceremony as much as, frankly, just engaging in culture. But yeah. In other cultures, like you mentioned, in the North American cultures, they'll certainly talk about ceremony as a daily practice, which is different to what you're reflecting. That's why I think that I would argue that ceremony they're reflecting is more what we talk about in terms ritual. Of living law.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea that we are practicing that all day in every relationship we have. And, you know, the ancestors are always still in my bloody car keys. So I'm not at all surprised that I have to, you know, have a word with them and spend some time.
But that's all, sit with that's them. Custom, you know.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean, in that way of saying that, more than
well, that's
ceremony.
Right.
I mean, it is, like we won't, wouldn't refer to that as ceremony because there's a whole different authority there.
That's right, exactly. And you're quite right that ceremony, I think, in the culture that we can speak to is that is a recognition from others and from yourself that this is something that you have to give deep consideration. Part of the importance of the relationship is recognizing that we've all got learning. And I've told you before that I've got a lot of learning to do. I've got different roles, but I've got a lot of learning to do. And that's a beautiful part of our culture. Mm. But the, you know, picking up on the point about law. So law is not, you know, we've understood law, I think, or rather we've misunderstood law to be something quite extant, something quite objective, something quite transactional that can be written, that can be recorded, that can be observed.
Mm.
When you know, law really is much more ineffable than that.
Yeah.
It is about the dark space relationships between us, between the stars, it's the space between us that is shared culturally. It's a whole range of things that have energy and power. It is agentic itself. Mm. It isn't a dead thing or a passive thing. Mm. I think that's why I say to you that whenever I hear some of those challenges being put by some of your interviewers and interviewees, I keep thinking, oh, gee, you know what? Laura would solve that. Laura takes it right up. Laura would take that right away. Take that problem right away. So it's why I think that the answer to
but
many
it's,
of the
it's
questions...
weird because I can't, I, that's what I don't want to do. That's where I don't have the, sorry, because I don't go in, I can't go in like with the Bible and I can't go, you know, I will hear this is what you need. You need our law. Here's the law here. You follow that and you'll be right. Here, do this. You know, I can't do that. I have to help them find their own.
Well, no, that's true. It's really all I can do. Of course, our law is not their law. Although, as you know, our old people would say that that ours is a first principle human story. And you know, it's for the whole world, which is part
first,
of
first principles.
That's right.
Mm.
So whilst our law is not necessarily something that we can biblically communicate to others, it is something nonetheless that is demonstrated through process. And that's what I really think matters in the conversations you've been having, that when I hear some of the questions about people who've got questions about, you talk about commons as an example or the structure of the commons. Now that's something that we see, but it's a consequence of a post-enlightenment construct of reductionism, of individualism, of greed that we solved.
Mm.
I'm not saying we got it perfect, but we even solved the resolution of when it was imperfect.
Yeah.
You know, through cultural justice principles and things of that effect.
Yeah.
So we'd solved for those things. You can't have, and I think this is a story that we don't tell enough. And it's something that I'm constantly, I just have to often sit back and just think about it. That even on its simplest mapping of Australia's nationhood, let's call it 250 just for the sake of it, 250 nation groups across this country. Mm. You can't have had that for 60 to 100,000 years in relationship to each other with, as you know, shared story, shared relationships, intermarriage laws and structures, principles of engagement. You can't have that for that length of time without open, devastating conflict, but instead every time our people found a way to say, no, that's not the way.
Mm.
That's not, so every other culture, every other country in the world has failed on that first test because somebody got greedy, somebody got power, somebody got narcissism. It funded every civilization has collapsed. And you know the stories that most civilizations last between 300 and 400 years. Mm. Ours lasted for 65,000 fucking years. There might be some lessons. There might just be something in there. Again, it's not by accident. Can't be by accident when you're talking about that scale of humanity and that scale of complexity and that scale of existence of time.
Well, that's always the next question. What they are, what really troubles them, because they can be really all in on our governance. Go, yeah, that's got great stuff. However, how can it scale? And it's the same issues they've got with trying to figure out how a DAO can scale or a cooperative can scale, which, you know, it can't in the way they're conceiving it. And I guess the way they're conceiving our governance models is that, you know, that can't scale either. But by goodness, it does.
Scaling is a good one. Scaling is a really good, because I know you've wrestled with that one. So you're absolutely right that scale in the Western construct, in the modern construct, is one of how do you get maximum benefit from minimum input, if you like, by even preferably automating scale. You're right. Our people basically said none of that can be automated. It must always be human. That's the first thing. It must always be human, including our responsibilities and relationships. You can't outsource them. You can't pass them over. You can't create tools or instruments that take them away. So firstly, they must be human.
Mm.
But secondly, my challenge to you about they can't scale is that they can't scale in the Western construct of leveraging where you have one-to-many relationships. They can absolutely scale and did scale. And those 250 nation groups are an example. When you have holonic constructions of scaling, when you have fractal relationships between all of those things. The closest we've got to this, and this is going to sound disturbing, the closest we've got to this in the Western sort of, well, in the recent, you know, last 100 years of dialogue is around, you know, the cells style structure.
In a scale.
Yeah, so on the scaling question, which is one I know that you've wrestled with, the way... We solve, our old people solved the scaling problem. You can't have 250 nation groups across the entire country subject to same principles of law and LAW law and in diverse countries, in diverse relationships, without thinking about how that was scaled. But the scaling problem in the post-Enlightenment tradition is a sort of a one-to-many construct of leverage, really, rather than scale.
Yep.
How can I get maximum output for minimum input? But our version of scaling is, of course, not that. It's a fractal version of scaling.
Mm.
It's holonic. It's the idea that, you know, how do you construct systems that are replicative relation, but are in relationship to each other? That's how you scale. You don't have the one relationship to many. You have multiple relationships to multiple relationships.
That's it.
Yeah. That's the scaling arrangement that we solved for.
Yep.
And it's like, can't do that in this.
But that's what they're looking for. Whenever they're asking about this question of scale, they're talking about how do we maintain these massive entities of states, you know, of governments, institutions, nations. How do we maintain these massive entities? How do we scale this governance up to that? And the problem where they don't want to go is where the answer is, which is, well, you scale it by descaling, really, in a way. You scale it by breaking it up. No, it's like a big antitrust thing. It's the same thing. For Australia, all it would mean was, instead of having this hierarchy of federal, state, and then local governments, it'd just be the other way around. The line of authority would be local government, state government, and then federal government. And go the other way.
And effectively.
You know, and that's where power and the autonomy and the sovereignty would lie, is in many sovereignties, syndicated. And that's the problem. That's where they can't go, because they don't want to go there for scale. Because no matter as much as they talk about decentralized, you know, stuff, what they really are looking for is having more individual autonomy to do whatever they want, and to escape accountability, and to escape any kind of obligation to the collective. And that's what they think about in terms of freedom. And that's what they want to escape by decentralizing the institutions. You know,
but all
you can't scale our governance models without increasing your obligation and relation. And that's exactly the thing the libertarians want to escape. So they don't want that answer. They're looking for something else.
Well, that's why I think that's why I'm always reminded when I hear that is, well, do you want the 100,000 years of proven evidence, or do you want the 100 years of proven failure? You know, which one do you want? You certainly can't scale your way out of those sort of challenges. And I'd say that what that boils down to, those challenges boil down to, ultimately, all of those sins you've reflected there are principles of greed or narcissism. People don't trust somebody else. That's a narcissism perspective. I'm the only one who's smart enough to solve this problem. Mm. People don't want to share power. That's narcissism. You know, I don't trust the other people or believe that power can be shared equally because I'm better than them.
Mm.
So it all boils down to our cultural evils of narcissism and greed, which our culture dedicates its entire life to beating out of people, as you know. That's its fundamental principle of engagement, is that those two things, every story is about those things. Mm. And imagine if every story of Western culture was about those two things, we'd have quite a different sort of outcome there. Yeah. But instead, as to your point, the libertarian argument is to valorize those things, is to celebrate those things, is to advertise those things.
Yeah,
the two things that we've attempted through learning over 100,000 years, saying, you know what, these things only ever lead to bad outcomes.
Mm.
These things can only lead to destruction. Mm. So we're not going to do them anymore. We're going to build stories that protect us from them.
And it's all coming out. It's all coming out from that. Sorry, man, because it's in the other side too, but it's two sides together. That's what's weird about it in that Californian ideology that we're dealing with, is that it's firmly grounded in Ayn Rand kind of stuff.
Mm.
And quite, has quite a hidden basis in eugenics sort of philosophy and all that kind of fascistic side of things. But at the same time, very liberal, very progressive coming out of the psychedelics movement. It's like a weird, unholy alliance of those two things, of almost the worst elements of the left and the right mashed together to make something that's not quite as good as either. It's kind of terrifying, that Californian ideology, I'm finding. And this libertarianism, it sounds great because they're offering you this thing, this freedom, and here, come on board, support this. But I don't think they actually see that you're going to be having that, or most people are going to be having that. That's for a few people who are the elect and who are, either by means of like technological means, gene therapy or whatever, or by right of birth, people who are somehow superior. Maybe they're people who can afford the cyborg sort of stuff or whatever. There's a kind of eugenics feel to it. They don't say it, but I feel like it's there. I feel like, it's just another big reshuffle, or like a revolution that will install it will just shuffle the oligarchs around a little bit. And that's about it. But we're still going to finish up under all these oligarchs, which that's all revolution is really, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is. It's changed.
And that's how I feel about Web3. That Web3 is just another revolution that's going to have us, feeling like we've been liberated, but we haven't. I feel like I've been in some shitty version of the metaverse for 2 years already. Like really, I feel like I've been living in a beta of the metaverse for 2 years, and that. It's really unsatisfying, and it really makes you sick. But at the same time, it's very seductive, and very addictive.
Well, the way let's talk about that for a second, because the way to, I think it's a completely reasonable argument to say that we already can see the end of Web 3.0 just by the fact that we can imagine its beginning, we can imagine its end. We already know it must collapse because it is absent of law, what they're trying to do is encode law through smart contract. But we know that that's process, not contract. That's process, not commitment. It's doing, not saying. So it must fail until we get to a position where the doing matters. So we already know the end of it. So therefore, in order to keep strong, in order to stay sane through that evolutionary process, it is anchoring back to culture. It is anchoring back to what principles are true. You know, what principles, what can we leave behind in the landscape for the future people that will follow us to be good ancestors?
Yeah.
And of course, those are principles of, well, it's only things like law. Now, law, again, I don't want to sound mystical. I'm talking here about practical process. I'm talking here about the idea that narcissism and greed give rise to utterly predictable outcomes, that there's no other way to colour it. You can't control for it. You can't compliance your way out of it. You can't ethic your way out of it. You can't legislate your way out of it. It's just inevitable. It's utterly inevitable. If you valorize those things, there is only one answer. It just might, the difference may be a position of time, but otherwise the answer is still inevitable. Now people know that. They learnt that and worked directly to stop it.
How do you feel, I don't know, I've never felt this before, but recently I felt a risk that we can lose this and that it can be destroyed. I've never felt that before until recently with all of the elders, and there's a good dozen that I know of who really, like, you know, lawmen who've been kind of lost to that very, that sort of alt-right libertarian right, whatever you want to call it, you know, philosophies, particularly the sovereign citizen movement and how that has colonized, like from the United States, it's colonized our land rights movement completely, so that our biggest, most staunch land rights people who held on and never gave in to the idea of native title and always stayed for land rights, that they're lost now to sovereign citizen movement and this weird sort of magical thinking from the States. So I know I'm not the only person going through this. I'm not the only person being seduced by the cocaine of Californian ideology. I know elders. There's elders that I respect and that I love and that I've lost my relationship with now because I can't go there with them. I can't go into that, you know, free man on the land, bloody... I can win a court case by bloody talking about my birth certificate and saying that if this is all in all capitals, then it has to be thrown out. And I don't know, if this flag's being flown, then it's not land, it's a ship and it's admiralty law and all this crap, bros. You know, this is a lawyer, that it's bullshit. And there's too many. I just got word today, another old fella up north, he's gone now on that.
Yeah,
fully subscribed, gone over that side, and it's gone. And I feel like it's in danger. You obviously don't. I do.
But
that law can be extinguished.
No, I do. But my confidence, my comfort, if you like, comes from the fact that, again, I think we're talking here about the fourth law of thermodynamics. As far as I'm concerned, is the construct of conservation of time. You know, we don't sufficiently think about time. And what I, you're certainly right to be anxious and sad, fearful, if you like, about what we're seeing amongst those elders. I though know, I believe that they are operating from positions of fear. That's how this seed gets planted. The seed gets planted because of a galvanizing element around a long-seated fear, which we've talked about before. That's the way in. That was the way in for the devil from the Catholic tradition. It's the way in for poor thinking from every other tradition. It's the way in for issues in our culture. You know, we've got stories of monsters that come at us in the dark, and you know, creatures and spirit beings that we need to be mindful of. They emerge from fear and have lessons to teach us. So I know they're coming from fear. That what we also know though is that I do believe deeply that if we were to get that those people are not following the right process. And we've heard that also challenged, as you know, in the public space around the way they want to engage in that conversation on somebody else's country. So whilst I have deep respect for them as elders, they're not following process. If they were following process, then we could, and are still arriving at the same conclusion, then I might be able to get behind some of the thinking. But our old people have always said, no, process matters. You come onto somebody's country, you perform certain things, you engage in certain things, you don't hold their story until they give you that story. You have no rights and power. You are a child on somebody else's country until such time as they accept you or identify you as
an owner.
So process has failed here. And so that's why I don't see it as a collapse of our culture. I see it as a collapse of individuals who have fallen under a particular spell through fear.
Well, that's where it gets difficult on some country if you've got, you know, two competing elder groups with competing claims, and each says the other's gammon and
Oh,
is
but
not
that's
from
usually
there.
about, but that's
And
usually
then,
about the other
but
side.
you, and you get welcome from one, but then you talk to the other, and then the other group doesn't like you talking to them, so they unwelcome you, and then that group's welcome to you, so you're half welcome from one mob and not welcome from the other, and you don't know how to be in that place. It's very difficult.
It is difficult, but I'm going to sound like a broken record by saying that, well, that's about the greed and or narcissism of one or both of those groups, and it has nothing to do with your relationship to the land. It has to do with their relationship to greed or narcissism,
But it also it
and that's the.
interferes with your process
It
of
does. It
following
does.
protocol to be in place and come
Yeah.
into place.
No, you're quite right. You're quite right.
So,
But
you
I
know, there
would.
is human. I know you say, you know, the land has worked for you, and that, you know, if you get a knock and it's from people, well, that's from people and that's not the land. But you still have to respect the people of the land,
Yes, you do.
even if they have dementia and they're just losing their mind on you, even if they're abusive narcissists, as you still have to respect those people. And I do, and that's what makes things difficult in some places.
Well,
You know,
I
because you
would
have to
argue
follow
that,
that.
yeah, you do, but what you have to
Otherwise, you're
follow.
just a white person who's walking around, like settlers are always walking around on country and connecting to country and going, I was gifted this feather. And you're like, by who? And they're like, oh, the land gave it to me. It's like, did it? Did the land give you, did they gift you that feather? Did that country gift you that feather, really? You know, and we know that's gammon.
Well,
Hey,
and
that
we certainly know
actually
that they
that
said
brings
it.
me, oh, I've got a really good story for this, bros.
All right.
I got something happened the other
Yes.
day. So we went to a beach. I won't say what country, but it's, you know, it's in Victoria.
Coastal.
It was a fair way. It was a fair way up. Anyway, so we're there in this place, and lots of rock on that beach, and we're walking along from looking at all that rock, and there's, you know, a big slab, long one of stone. And there's lots of big run grooves. You know how the water will wear grooves, and there's these grooves in there. And I look in one, and I see this perfect stone that's been jammed in that groove for a very long time, and it's kind of been shaped into like this little perfect hand axe. And it's been there for a long time, like centuries. And I reach down, and it just comes loose in that moment. Like, whoa, I'm King Arthur here. Bruvs, that's Excalibur, that's a sword and a stone. And this stone fits my hand perfectly. And I've been thinking hand axe, because I gave my other stone axe to my son, and he's got it there in Cairns. And so I'm like, ah, yeah, so yeah, for this next thing that I'm thinking of making, yeah, I got this hand axe. Country, just give me this axe. And it felt really good, and I felt amazing good vibes, energy coming up my arm from that stone. And it went right through my body. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, yet there's just a tiny little bit more grinding I got to do along that. It's like the sea had done this ground edge perfectly and made me this axe, you know? And then I sat there and I just went, no, I don't have permission to take this. I can't just take this, you know? It feels like the sea's giving it to me, but I don't know if that's some weird, you know, infection from this, some other hemisphere about Arthurian legend and the sword in the stone. Maybe it's some weird demonic northern hemisphere shit coursing through my cells. I don't know that. You know, I can't be certain about this. And when I look at it and I think I just need to do a little bit more work, maybe a day or two on that ground edge, and I'm thinking, well, maybe that's actually something the sea needs to do for another century or two. And so I put it back in that exact same spot. And I left it there and walked away. And the way I feel about it is that is a tool that I'm working on. It's just I've got another century or two of work to do on that tool there. And so that's where it is. So it's me and that stone and that place in the sea all working on that for another century or two. And I walk away because that country is not giving me, is not gifting me something just because I felt like that's what was happening at the time. And it felt like, oh, well, the timing of that, of releasing this stone after centuries from this crack straight into my hand, that's got to be, it's just, I saw two signs there. I didn't see three, and I always triangulate if I'm taking a message from country, you know. So in the end, I had to override my feeling for that one, and I left it there.
The third sign you might have been looking for probably would have come with time. So my question would be, did you get a chance to sit in country with that for a bit? Did you light a fire and spend some time with it?
Yeah, I did.
Because that might be the third sign. But
I think it's got to come from elders then, the third sign.
That's right. Yeah.
If they ever tell me to go back and take that one, then I'll do it.
Yeah.
But it might be a couple of lifetimes down the track too.
Yeah,
my point. Like that it's something I'm working on. But it might be a couple of centuries, and I've got to be happy with that model of time.
But you know what?
With that time frame.
The gift of that stone isn't about the stone. The gift of that axe isn't about that position. The gift of that stone is the story of it, and the fact that maybe the stone actually will create has that story in it.
Yeah.
Maybe it looks a lot more like that ground stone than your first version was going to look like. Maybe it's got the same colours, and then therefore maybe it has that story in it. The axes aren't just for the production or the destruction of, you know, animals or carving or chopping wood. They also have story of origin. So the gift of that stone's already a gift.
Well, the story of the stone was quite remarkable. I sat with it for a long time. And it was real living rock. And that story of the flesh that is earth, because the way the sea had worked on it had polished it to the point that it looked like flesh. You know, when you just take the skin off, it looked like flesh. And it looked living, moving, breathing. And it was. And I'd never seen anything like that. It was quite extraordinary. Anyway, I feel like it needs another century or two.
Well, that's a good story for what you're trying to say here. Is that's a governance process you just worked through.
Yeah. True.
And so how we translate that to the sort of thinking you were doing now around your other stuff is, so how do we resolve some of these how do we resolve direction? Because governance, remember, from indigenous culture is not just about controlling and constraint. It's about creating permissioning pathways and safety environments and environments within which you can learn and produce safely. So, and our stories tell us that, our law tells us that, our relationships tell us that. So that sounds to me like you're operating there in good governance. So how do you take that into the rest of your decisions around maybe even the finishing of the book? That I know you're coming towards the end of it and you're not sure how it shapes and feels in your hands. Sounds to me a bit like a stone. Is the stone somebody else's stone? Is that, you know, the way I'm seeing your situation right now is that because you're doing the David Attenborough thing, you think you're telling the story of other people and other systems. But, you know, you're experiencing your own relationship to all of that. You know, you're living it and you can't separate those two. Nor can you. The stone was living. The stone was in relationship to that cliff face. It's in relationship to the ocean, in relationship to the wind, in relationship to the sandblasting, in relationship to you now that you've come into it. You can't disassociate yourself from Web 3.0 or future thinking. You're in it. You're part of it.
I feel like you're seeing more of the landscape than I actually mentioned in the story there.
I am, you know. I'm seeing it.
I'm not saying anything. I'm not giving any more clues where that is. And all people go look for it. You know, people are like all kinds of treasure hunters in this world.
So you're lighting the smoke, and I'm smelling it. That's it.
Oh well, I'm feeling more connected and related, in a way. This thing that's making more meaning to me. That story doesn't mean anything while it's just in my head, because I haven't talked to anyone about that yet. Well, no one outside of my family, you know, like immediate family. But so, yeah, talking to you helps me make some meaning. That Wanju thing that we're doing in the lab, that collective sense-making way, and then Bunya Mountains protocol there. Yeah. No, it's helping me make sense of it. Look, it's important. And there's another big message there too, is that because you're saying it might not be you personally that's finishing that axe. And it's like, yeah, this is true. But that's true of everything. And this book, it's not personally my book. You know, this is another problem, is they're trying to maintain this illusion of personal property. And they're trying to figure out a way to keep all their shit as the system collapses. And that's the problem that they're trying to solve here. And what they don't realize is that that belongs to all of us. And if someone comes up with an idea, someone comes up with code, or, you know, they come up with some kind of intellectual property, that doesn't just belong to them. You know, that comes out of a lot of infrastructure that a lot of people paid for in their taxes, that a lot of people work towards. It comes out of disciplines that generations of people for centuries, that knowledge was contributing to building. You know, all of these things, everything that people produce and they think is their intellectual property, it's not. You know, that's coming from all of us over time. And it's the same with this book. I never feel like that first book people talk about. So I'm very uncomfortable with praise, people telling me, oh, that's an amazing book, you're amazing kind of thing. It's like, well, it's not mine. You know, every thought in there's not one thought that's my own, like that I can claim to have just originated out of this amazing starseed child, freaking, you know, unique being in the universe that is me, that is floating around, cut off from everything else. Everything there come out of relation and came out of deep time relation too. It's the same like that rock, you know, like that hand axe that the sea's making, you know, and it's making me, and I'm part of that. I'm part of the story of that hand axe now. And then, you know, in a couple of centuries, someone will finish it. And that person might say, this is my axe. And my axe. There's another Lord of the Rings thing there. And I'll just be like, nah, that's not yours. It's like, that belongs to all of us. So don't get too.
Well, you know, the way you place that rock back, the way you place that rock back in that shelf will have different effect on the way it's, you know, the way it grows and molds and moves over its next relationship.
That's but, it. You know,
as you were just talking there, it reminded me that I think that maybe one of the ways into this challenge about how you finish this book is that your first book, as you say, you were channeling or connecting or communicating, if you like, something that is not yours, but nonetheless is necessary. In the second book, as you navigate future versions of what the world wants to shape itself as, and you're using this reverse anthropological sort of approach, the way you've positioned yourself, I think, or the way you naturally position yourself is observer and participant and guide, if you like. When in fact, I think what I'm hearing you say is that the gap is, and the thing that you are concerned is missing, is you don't actually need to be, people need you to be the observer. People need you to tell them what's there. But what they need from you particularly, or what they need from us, if you like, from a cultural relational perspective, is how do we navigate this new future?
That's it.
So, and that's the governance. So the question for you for the second half of the book isn't simply a sort of a taxonomy of the future, but a how do we navigate it?
That's it.
And that's why I'm talking to you about Indigenous law, Indigenous governance, because that has navigated us successfully for 100,000 years. It will navigate us successfully for the next, if we can find a way to communicate it. So my encouragement to you, my challenge to you, is that the second part of your book has to be, how will we navigate the turmoil of this future?
Well, that I think that stone story will be the hinge that it turns on. So the chapter that's the second half or last part of the book, I think I'll have to put a chapter in there for that one. For that stone that I'm sitting with, and that'll be the turning point. And you know what, if I don't get that right, I'm not going to be able to let anyone read this book, because it's just wrong story so far.
And well, don't create blockages for yourself.
But I'm exploring a world of wrong story.
Yeah,
and it is damaging me. And basically at the moment it's like a autoethnography of a series of psychotic breaks.
Yeah.
You know, basically that I'm going through in dialogue with the world. And, you know, the way I'm trying to make sense of that, and just I'm still in this rip I'm still there at that beach, and I'm in that rip, and I'm getting sucked out further and further and further, and getting tired swimming, you know. And yeah, so I guess I need to be able to come back in. I need to be able to find my way back in order to give people a sense of hope, at least in a narrative way of that. Oh, there's a way that we can come back from this. There's a way we can get through this. I don't know. I just can't see it yet, but hopefully I'll find it, bros.
Well, you know what that rock tells me as well, or what I'm thinking about now on that is that is that rock, as you say, it just came away.
Mm.
So it's been shaped by that relationship to that rock face, by the wind and the weather and the rain and the water. Mm. But it came away. So it's fragile. It was connected. It was connected, but not locked in to that rock system. Mm. And that's a story for you too.
Mm.
That the rock was loose, but can be put back.
Yeah.
And is still in relationship to that
rock. It can be put back. Yeah.
That's right.
You can't take that until you're ready. You know, on that same coast, I pulled a settler lady out of the surf a few weeks back. Yeah, we're just walking. It was a very cold day, and I was sick. I had a bad cough, you know, and I was just about to leave because the kids wanted to see the beach, but it was too cold, too windy, and so we're heading back for the car. And we suddenly hear this screaming, and there's this lady out there getting sucked out to sea kind of thing, and smashed across all these rocks and everything. So I run down and went out and got her and brought her back in, which, you know, with me at the moment, my body is bad. Like, I've never been in bad shape like this before. Fat, can't breathe half the time. You know, when you get so fat that tying up your shoelaces, like, makes you pant for like 15 minutes. I'm like that, so I don't know where this come from. I was just walking along the beach, and I'm limping. I'm thinking, oh, man, my legs don't work anymore. And, like, my chest is, I'm like, oh, I couldn't run right now if my life depended on it. I think I'm, like, just crippled up now, and this is me, finished. And anyway, I think it was, like, country telling me something, because I had to sprint then, and I could sprint. And I sprint right down, dive in, went out, got this lady, brought her in, and she was all right. And then I get like pneumonia after that and spend bloody 3 weeks just freaking languishing. You know what I mean?
You know what? I do know. And you know what's really powerful about that is that you ran for others, but you can't run for yourself.
Yeah. But my point is, why am I, the story is telling me I'm doing all this running for not my own people.
Yes. That's what I was going to say is that the book, is the book, you have to frame your relationship to the book as a gift for others.
Mm.
And that will allow you to run with it because it's not about you. So the first book flowed easily because it was you channeling for others. Mm. The second book's flowing less easily because it's, you don't know who the others are because you keep being distracted by the cocaine candy of the American voices or all these other people who think the book's for them. Yeah. They think the book's about them. This whole other community of people that are trying to IP or steal space or own the agenda. Or the narrative, they think the book's for them. You need to decide who the book's for.
Yeah.
And I think the book is for, just like the rock is for. The book is not for now. The book is for, the book is a tool for how people navigate these problems in the future. So it's the navigation that I think is the anchor of the second part of your book.
Mm.
That's a governance process. How do we work our way through this as a problem-solving technique?
Yeah,
how do we bring our knowledge together to say this is how we'd think about this problem from a cultural perspective.
Hmm. Well, I think I'll find it there and find my own way through too. Yeah,
you know this mess.
I know it in my head, bros, but that's not the problem. There's no problem with my epistemology at the moment, my thinking. With my thinking, but not with my knowledge. The knowledge is fine. It's the same as the knowledge that was there before. It's the ontology, it's the being, specifically being in relation. I'm in bad relation. So that's why I'm talking to you. That's a HR thing, because knowledge is nothing if you're in bad relation. So it's coming to that.
Good relation doesn't mean, I just want to also tell you that good relation doesn't mean spending 3 weeks in the bush around a campfire. Good one. Mm. And you know this.
Yeah, I do.
A good relation can be spending that 10 minutes with that rock, that 2 days of that rock, that 1 hour with that rock. Okay. Yeah. Pulling that old lady from the sea, reminding you that that's part of our job is to protect all these white people in our country because they don't know how to live in relationship with this country.
True God.
Part of our job here is to help them come into relationship with this country.
Mm.
And unfortunately, and the, because you're operating in the global digital spheres, and so am I in my own work, I recognize that my job is to help the rest of the world come into relationship with that too. Mm. But that's a lonely place.
Yeah.
And you can only do that from the strength of understanding your connection to this country. So I know I keep saying it, but it doesn't mean spending a month in the bush. It can just be listening for an hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sounding like a preacher now on that.
I think spending a month in the bush. Yeah. It's like, that's where I went wrong. I think starting out, I don't know, with the book and with the goal of writing it in a week. So I had this idea of some kind of splendid isolation, like Hemingway or something out in the bush. Yeah. And I wouldn't have any distraction. And it's like, no. And I spent the whole time connecting with country and connecting with community there. I sit down with the old fellas, sit down with the young fellas all day, all night, bloody, and what I only got like four chapters done.
Yeah.
But
those four chapters were better for it, one assumes.
You'd have to assume, wouldn't you? But it's, but it all went to hell when I got back. Yeah, because I'm out of relation here. You know, going and being on country there, country brought people to me, you know. It's like, I don't know. So I'm there and I'm about to write the chapter that has a stone knife. I've made a flint knife for that chapter and I'm about to start writing that. And, you know, fellas pull up out the front and like, hey, how you going? We're all making stone knives up on the ridge this morning. You want to come up? I'm like, what? And so up I go and I spend the whole day making stone knives with all these young fellas and then talking to the old fellas and coming into relation that way. And I don't know, I'm like, oh, okay. That's what I'm doing then. You know, country puts you on the right track in the end. It's never where you want to be, but it's where you need to be.
Now the two don't come into alignment.
Mick Jagger said that. Mick Jagger said that best probably.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's right. All right, Buzz. I'm happy to, you know, if you want to catch up again as you navigate through the rest of this, then let's do that. We've got some further stuff to talk about. But if you want to move on to governance or if you want to talk about anything, I'm here for you in this conversation.
Yep. I think that's all we've done is talk about governance today. But yeah,
as long as you've heard that.
And it's been a perfect perfect bit of HR and appropriate authority. Thanks, brother.
All right, look after yourself.
All right. No worries.
Love you.
Same way.